Welcome to the Seasons of Sobriety podcast. This is a podcast where you can join in the journey of other recovering alcoholics and addicts. You'll be on the road with them as you listen to how each person came into recovery and how they persevere through times of anger, sadness, fear, and joy. I'm your host, Howard M. I am here to share my own experience as well as the experience of other recovering brothers and sisters. I am so grateful you have decided to join me today. This episode features Marcus M. from West Caldwell, New Jersey. Marcus has been sober since June 1st of 1986. Marcus's story starts at the very young age of 16, where he was fortunate to admit to his innermost self that he had a problem with alcohol and drugs. Thanks to his surroundings and the supportive family, he was able to attend meetings and begin his journey. He also had the opportunity to repay the kindness and generosity back to his mother when she needed him most during her battle with cancer. Marcus also had the opportunity to repair a damaged relationship with his father when challenged with letting go of old ideas formed during his sobriety. Here now is my interview with Marcus M. Hello, Marcus. I'd like to welcome you to the Seasons of Sobriety podcast.
Thank you, Howard.
I'd like to start off with, you know, back in 1986, it's April or May, and you are 16 years old, right? And yes. You are about to have a pretty significant life change. You know, maybe you want to, maybe you don't. And can you tell the audience a little bit what was happening just before you came into recovery?
Yeah, certainly. I do want to add, I'm really happy to be here today. So and then just to jump right in. As you said, I was 16 years old. I come from a family of five. All five have identified as alcoholics. That's relevant to my story later on, but my disease is my own. I just always like to add that. It has nothing to do with my family. So I was 16 years old. I was a sophomore in high school. I was drinking and drugging as much as I could legitimately buy or beg or borrow or steal. My two older brothers were attempting to establish their own little marijuana distribution empire. My parents were in their cups. My dad was drinking after work or on frequent business trips, quote unquote. My mother was making the round of psychiatrists looking for her next prescriptions for pills. So that's just the family background. For me, I was spending all of my time outside of school. There was my local dealer's house, and it was really stereotypical, what you would almost think of as a stereotypical dealer's house. He lived in what I've come to understand is a mother-in-law cottage, so a little house behind the house. But there was absolutely no mother charm about it. He had a Doberman tied up front on a big chain. That was the obstacle to getting in. That was the gate. He was the gatekeeper. So he had to dodge past all the dog crap and the dog and get to the door. And it was just a dark, wet hovel with a mattress on the floor in the back. And, a couple people, sort of strung out on the couch, passed out on the couch, and the dealer. That's where I spent all my time. My brothers were wild men. As I mentioned, they were dealing drugs and getting in fights and doing whatever they needed to do. The reason I mentioned that is I was always, the good kid. And I just, I think my disease brain sort of intuitively knew if I keep my sidewalk act one or two notches below theirs, I'll be able to fly under the radar and do whatever I want to do, which is drink and drug. So it was pretty, with five active alcoholics under one roof, everybody lived at home at this time. It was a really uncomfortable place. On the best of days, you could cut the tension with a knife. On the worst days, there would be maybe a new hole in the drywall, where someone had gotten angry and punched a new hole. So I liked to just avoid all of the mess. I really wasn't much of a rebel, or no police cars or flashing lights in my story. I really just wanted to get baked. I just wanted to, as I like to say, beam me up, Scotty. I once heard a guy at a meeting say, "My problem as an alcoholic is here, now, and you. I'd rather be anywhere but here, anytime but now, and with anyone but you." And that's really how I felt. So I spent all my time at this drug dealer's house, just getting as wasted as I could, just drinking as much as I could, or using drugs as much as I could. There was one kid that I grew up with who drank like I did. You know, any normal sort of kid activities had long gone out the window. I, in grade school, I had been an A student, played little league ball, and all of that, you know, I quickly found out got in the way of drinking and drugging. So all that had long gone. So this one guy, Scotty, who I hung out with, we would, you know, sometimes literally scour the streets for the last nickel or dime it took to buy a six pack from the bodega that would sell to underage kids. I was with him one day and we stopped by his house and his mother came home and he said, "Well, Marcus, it's time for me to go to my meeting." And I'm like, "What, Scotty, what are you talking about?" And he said, as it turns out, his stay at home was contingent on him going to meetings. His parents were in recovery and, you know, they were forcing him to go to meetings if he wanted to live at home. So he said, "Do you want to go?" And I was blindsided and I just didn't know what else to say. So I just blurted out a yes. So that was my very first meeting. I do have to add, my mother had started to go to meetings like 6 months previously, so AA wasn't completely foreign to me. I'd actually seen her go from being depressed and full of pills and kind of a cowed human being. You know, you could see a change in her. She was starting to perk up and, you know, she loved going to meetings and she generally actually started to seem pretty happy. And I think that sort of, you know, that fact filed away in my brain somewhere. So I was at least knew what AA was when Scotty invited me to a meeting and I went and I don't know why I raised my hand when they said, "Is anybody new here?" I didn't know enough to just sit in the back and hide. So the meeting was directed at me. I had a death grip on the side of my chair thinking, "What are these people going to do? What are they going to say? What do they want?" And as they went around the room, I heard little bits and pieces of my story and things that I could identify, like, wow, that person thinks like I think. They drink like I drink. And, you know, so here's this room full of people who had been in where I had been, where I was currently was. And most of them had been in many worse situations than me. Yet here they were. Yeah. They were clear-eyed and sober and laughing, comfortable on their own skin. You know, everything that I wasn't at that moment. And I didn't stay sober after that first meeting. I just, my takeaway from that first meeting was, I'm glad these people have found what they needed. So if I ever need it, I know where to go. For whatever reason, my parents were on my case at this time. They didn't, you know, my brothers were, you know, my mom was new in sobriety. My dad was you know, still active. My brothers were, you know, the household was still crazy. So my drinking and drug use, for the most part, was still pretty much, you know, still flying under the radar. But my parents knew something was up. My mom knew something was up. So to get her off my case, I did just tell her, you know, I went to a meeting and, you know, and she said, "Do you think you have a problem with alcohol and drugs?" "Yes, I do." So really, it was just to get her off my case so I could continue to do what I wanted to do, which again is just drink and drug. So I continued to do that for a little bit, just for a couple of months. I actually did go to a few meetings, you know, just for appearance's sake. And then I came to be, you know, the day came, which turned out to be the day I hit my bottom. And that was, I was with this guy, Scotty. Again, he was going to meetings, but he hadn't stopped drinking and drugging. And we were with two or three other kids roaming the neighborhood. And one of the guys said, you know, "This is my parents' house," you know, and he'd been kicked out of the house, but he said, "This is my parents' house. I know they're not home. Why don't we break in and we'll have a place to party," which sounded reasonable to everybody. Like I said, I really wasn't I wasn't much of a rebel, wasn't into trouble. I just wanted to get, you know, drunk or stoned. So I didn't go in, you know, when they found a big rock and bashed in the door, I didn't go in. And then the thought occurred to me, hey, wait a minute, they have the alcohol. And so that was the decision set right there. So I went in and we ransacked the place. You know, I got, you know, absolutely obliterated that day. And I have to say, I started that day stealing $10 from my brother so that I could buy whatever I needed.
Sure.
And so by the end of that, I just, you know, I'd reached a point where I hated myself. I hated who I was, what I was doing. I hated everybody I was hanging out with. I hated life. And, you know, at the end of this day, we didn't get caught. On the way home, I just knew that as sucky as this day was, as horrible as I felt about myself, you know, I was no longer able to drink or drug enough to sort of get that release that I used to get. Mm-hmm. I knew that this day was as good as it was going to get, that it was just going to be downhill from here. Mm-hmm. And although I don't think I could have articulated it at the time, you know, I knew that I'm powerless. You know, alcohol leads me around by the nose. Where I go, who I hang out with, what I do, that's all determined by the alcohol and drugs. And so I just hit that point where I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to live like this anymore. So that was May 31st, 1986. And, you know, it was a rocky start, but that was my beginning to joining recovery, joining AA.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that blessing of knowing that this is as good as it's going to get, and this is awful, and you have to turn it around, you know, and reaching that point at 16, you know, and really those guys kind of helped you, right? You know,
yeah.
and reach that point, but, you know, when there's just nowhere to go but down, it's a tough place to be.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Was Scotty similar age to you, or was he older?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, same age.
And same situation. Interesting.
Okay. Yeah.
And then, because he was under all these, you know, the house restrictions and yeah. I think hearing that, it also gave a sense that you weren't alone. You weren't the only 16-year-old that you knew that had this kind of problem.
Yeah. Yes. That is definitely true. The meetings at that time, there weren't tons of young kids at meetings. You know, there were still smoking meetings back then. So you'd just walk into a hazy room with, you know, there's an old timer in the corner with his arms folded on his stomach with a stogie that was sort of setting the cigarette, you know, the smoke tone, and mm-hmm. not many kids. The high school I happened to be in, there were a couple of other kids in recovery. And I do have to say that in the beginning, you know, it was really touch and go. It was really touch and go. I went to meetings all the time. That helped to save my bacon. But once I was at school, you know, there were really, it's a miracle I didn't pick up.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, there was actually one instance where it was just because, you know, the guy who was supposed to sell us something didn't show up. But I do remember in that first 6 months or so, you know, seeing, you know, this one kid that I knew I'd seen him at meetings, and I saw him bopping down the hall, coming in the other direction with his headphones on. He didn't see me. And I just remember thinking, he's doing it. And if he could do it, maybe I can do it too.
Yeah. Yeah. We have a lot of these, I call them, first of all, seeds get planted, right? You know, your mom was going for a little while and you knew people were going. And then we have, it's called our pace cars. Like, oh, well, you're getting better and you were worse than me. So, Perhaps I could get better, right?
Yeah. Yes.
That's good. All right. So let's take this a little bit further. So let's say you're like you said, your first 6 months were still a little touch and go, difficult. When did it occur to you that I'm here. I'm sticking around. Where was the shift in that? Do you recall?
Yeah, it was, you know, I do have to say it was right away that I knew I wanted to be here. So it wasn't so much that I didn't want to be there as I just, you know, I didn't immediately get a sponsor. I didn't immediately, you know, sort of get hooked into the program. You know, I went to lots of meetings. I stayed as invisible as I could in the back of the room. I think a big turning point for me was probably like 2-3 months later when someone had talked about, you know, that they weren't craving today. And it occurred to me that for that day, I wasn't craving. And that, for me, that was huge. Mm-hmm. So that was a light bulb went on. First of all, this was like, wow, I experienced a day without craving.
Yeah.
And then maybe there's something additional to this. So that was definitely helped me keep going.
Okay. And so now you're moving along and you're at this point where, all right, I need to start to do some work, and I need to pick somebody to do that work with. So can you describe a little bit about, you know, your process and getting a sponsor and starting the steps?
Yes, it was actually a very long process, but I'll keep the story short. Like I said, I'm just an average, nugget-headed, stubborn alcoholic. So in the beginning, I did just think that, I really just was operating on the first half of the first step, you know, not really consciously, but I just thought, I had this idea that if I don't pick up a drink or a drug, I'll be fine. That the reason I got into all this mess was because, you know, I was drunk, I was stoned. So as long as I don't pick up, I'll be just fine. I did have a sponsor right away, just because, you know, they said you should have one. But I saw him at meetings. We made coffee together on a Thursday night. I never actually spoke to him about anything. So that was sponsor number one. Sponsor number two was a little bit later on, you know, because now that, you know, once you put down the alcohol and drugs, you know, you've put down the anesthetic. You know, so now life starts to get real, you know, and now I'm going to high school. I don't have an alcohol or drugs. You know, I'm trying to deal with school, with friends, with family. By this point, other people, you know, other family members were coming into the programs. The house was, you know, went from, you know, wet, crazy alcoholics to dry, crazy alcoholics. Right. So I knew I needed more. And so I got another sponsor. And this sponsor I did start to talk to a little bit. This was probably close to a year in, and I did talk to a little bit and actually did start on the steps. I did actually did, you know, steps one, steps two, steps three, attempted a step four. And this step four was really, if I look back on it, wasn't fearless and thorough at all. And the sponsor, when I met him to go over it, I think he actually had forgotten. You know, I don't think I was number one sponsee on his list. And we met, you know, he did look a little surprised, and he picked up what I'd written, you know, and he, as I've heard other people share at meetings, you know, he took my fourth step. He said, "See all this that you've written?" And he tore it up. He said, "You're not that person anymore." Mm. And for the moment that worked, you know, I'm like, okay, great. I've done the fourth step. But, you know, time continued, and,
Or as I like to say, you've done a version of the fourth step. I've noticed there are many versions.
That's exactly right. So what got me to the sponsor that really made a difference in my life, and the version of the fourth step that made a difference in my life, was I was actually 3 years in. It's through my second year. You know, so of course I'm not following any suggestions, and so I got a girlfriend, and as you can imagine, you know, newly sober or newly dry, this relationship was a mess. I was crazy. She was crazy. And, it was on my third anniversary, and we'd gotten into an argument about something. And I lived, I'm originally from upstate New York. Okay. So there's some distance between towns, and she lived one town over, a couple of towns over. A lot of country roads and fields between towns.
It could be a 30-40 minute drive sometimes between.
Or even longer walk. So I was over at her place, and we got into this argument, and she just went bananas and started to punch, hit, scratch, pull my hair. And I remember just being dumbfounded, like, what do I do? And, you know, I wasn't going to hit her, but I'm like, how do I get out of this? So she's got a grip on my hair. The phone rang, and for whatever reason, she decided it was more important to pick up the phone than to continue to pull my hair and scratch and punch. And I didn't need another minute. I just, you know, bolted out the back door, tried to be cool and walk through the streets, kind of, you know, cool, and then made it, you know, and then just started to run and head for home. And this girl, she drove Ford Fairmont. Not the cool Ford Fairlane, but, you know, crappy product from, I don't know, early 80s, you know, and it had bad alignment. So, you know, when she drove, the tires would make this sound. And evidently she got in the car looking for me and was trying to run me down. So here I was, you know, two towns away. And every time I tried to, like, walk down the road, I'd hear that in the distance, and I'd have to dart off the road. So I ended up trekking home through, you know, miles and miles of, you know, woods, farmers' fields, swamps, and I'm covered in burrs and, you know, prickers. My feet are wet, And it's at this point I had a spiritual awakening. And, I say that half in jest, because the thought did occur to me that I can't blame this on the alcohol and drugs anymore.
Yeah.
You know, I'm three years dry, you know, that comfortable assumption that all of my troubles are purely from alcohol and drugs was, you know, false, was proved false right here. And I got on my knees and said a prayer. And although I'd said many prayers in the rooms, you know, before and after meetings, I think that this was the first, I don't know if it was the first earnest one. It was certainly the most first heartfelt prayer. You know, I got on my knees and I said, God, help me. I can't do this alone. And that was the beginning of a beginning for me as my next sponsor, I used to say, you know. And so I just immediately thought of a man. You know, he really walked the walk, and this gentleman started to take me through the steps.
Wow. Yeah. It's, I really, think about that point, you know, for me, even, you know, I got sober when I was 21, and I took it early on. I realized that the alcohol wasn't really, it was a problem, but not the problem. And like you said, you're doing things years later in sobriety, and you haven't had a drink in years, so it can't be the alcohol anymore. And this is now where the character building or tearing down in some cases begins, yeah. You know, and rebuilding it. And, you know, that again, in this moment, as you're describing going down and down, it brought you to a place where you could say, all right, I'm willing to call the guy who knows what to do, rather than trying to do it my way.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, nice. And so I was thinking, so you were 19 in this relationship, which she was also about the same age?
At this point, I was, so 19. Yeah, okay. 19.
19. Yeah, again, even if you weren't in AA, your first relationship at 19 is probably not going to be, you know, top notch either way. But, and was she in the program?
No, not at all.
Okay.
She actually wasn't a drinker.
Okay. She was just a hair puller.
Yeah, yeah, just, right. just a hair puller. Yeah.
She just dabbled in that every now and then.
Yeah.
And like you said, you know, this, some people, you know, the evolution of beginning the four step, you know, may take 3 years, may take, you know, more than just, you know, the first, you know, 30 days in the program. And I think a lot of people, I don't know, they put themselves down sometimes where it's like, oh, it took me longer than it should have. Did it? You know,
right.
Because right. If you're not ready and you show, and you try to have me write a four step and I'm not ready. Yeah. I'm just going to go through the motions without really.
Right. You
know, it's just homework at that point. It's not really heartfelt.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. That is something I like to talk about with newcomers or people like myself who have been around who aren't newcomers, but that are stalled or not going. I try to share that, my story a little bit. My story is full of that. You know, it's just mm-hmm. very stubborn. And it took me a while to get going, and that's okay.
Yeah. Right. Now, once you did get going, how long did it take you to get that fourth step done? Do you remember that first one? First serious one, I guess?
Not long. Okay. This fourth step with this current sponsor, is that what you're talking about?
The one now with, you're ready to really do it. So yes, with that one.
Yeah. Not long. It actually, it took me overnight.
Ah, yeah. Okay.
Whereas my first, the very first attempt at a fourth step took me days.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, I had, you know, a pen, a pencil, an eraser, and a ruler. I'm not sure what the ruler was for. This time, you know, I knew I was ready. I knew that, you know, I didn't feel equal to everyone else in the room. I still didn't feel comfortable in my own skin. I was still full of fear and shame and resentment. And I just intuitively knew that all of that was between me and any person I encountered. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that idea of, you know, true kinship or partnership with other human beings, you know, I just knew that I wasn't experiencing that. And that feeling, and that feeling of apartness and aloneness, that actually prompted me to the fourth step. So when I picked it up, I, at my sponsor's suggestion, did it by the book, you know, listing the columns and the resentments. And I did it overnight on a overturned laundry hamper, prayed before I put pen to paper, and then just went to town. And, you know, I don't know, 4 o'clock in the morning, I was finished. And I did really, you know, that last column, you know, we're in the big book, you know, it's, very cleanly shows that, you know, fear, you know, I didn't really understand that at that point. So I didn't, that last column just wasn't filled out. My sponsor, he's of the firm belief that, you know, once you write this stuff down, this is the stuff that really fuels your drinking. Mm. This is the stuff that fuels your disease. You do not write this stuff down and then sit around on it. So he said, as soon as you're done, you call me. And so I was up till 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning, called him, at a reasonable hour, a few hours
for
later.
Him. Right. Yeah.
And he made we made an appointment to meet that evening.
Okay. And how was that first fifth step?
It was incredible. It was incredible. I didn't have the classic one thing that I'm not going to mention to anybody, and it didn't make it onto the paper, as thorough as I was. This is a man who was, I guess at that time, he was probably in his late 50s, maybe 60, married, had two kids. And like I said, he walked the way he talked. His wife was in the program, and we met. We went to a meeting together. So it was like 9:30. We had to head back to his house. We're sitting at the kitchen table, you know, as kids come in to say goodnight, you know, and I'm feeling, you know, really like I'm sticking out like a sore thumb and really nervous. I'm like, oh my God, your daughter's coming in. And, you know, I'm about to blurt everything out on the table here. And, you know, he encouraged me. He said, let's do this as a conversation. Let's do this face to face. You know, let's talk. If you need to refer to what you wrote just to, you know, jog your memory, that's fine, but let's talk. And for everything that was on my list, you know, he would sort of pause, he would pause after each item that was on my list, and he'd share his own story. Mm-hmm. And so I really got to see where he was the same. But yet he had more to say, not just that he could identify with me, but he would just talk about, you know, where he'd gotten to with each of these items. And he talked about really what the motivating factor was. And that's, you know, that last column in the big book where mm-hmm. it was really fear, self-centered fear that drove it. So I really began to understand that with each of the resentments on my list, you know, each of the things that I'd done that I was ashamed of, and the sexual inventory, all of that I could see where fear was motivating it. So, you know, it was almost like a mini private AA meeting for mm-hmm. every item on my fourth step list. That's the way I describe it. Mm-hmm. So by the time we got to the end, you know, that there was no doubt in my mind that one item that I'm not going to share with anyone, you know, I shared that as well. You know, and then we ended, and you know, again, here it is, it's like 2-3 o'clock in the morning. And he encouraged me to, you know, consider what we'd written or what I'd written and what we talked about. And, you know, did I want to continue? So he's setting me up for step 6 and 7 mm-hmm. right mm-hmm. away.
Yeah. And if what I'd like you to do, if you're okay with it, is from that first 4 step, is there one particular insight you learned about yourself that you're like, oh my gosh, I never knew it, and I'm really glad I know this now.
Yeah. Yes. There's one of my resentments, against my father. Mm-hmm. You know, my parents at this point, my family wasn't one of those families that got sober and stayed together. You know, after sobriety, my family fractured. You know, my parents split up, you know, soon to be divorced. My brothers headed for the hills. You know, the family was so dysfunctional. They went about their own way. My father actually took a job overseas. He was in China during the time of the protests in Tiananmen Square. Uh-huh. You know, we didn't have a good relationship. I thought he was kind of a cruel guy, and you know, I was just happy not to have this unpleasant relationship. And I really didn't think he liked me at all. Mm-hmm. So I had this resentment against him. And what I learned out of the fifth step was I had a particular insight. You know, so I knew that this is one thing that I'm going to have. You know, out of everything that's on my fifth step, this is one that's going to be a tough nut to crack. That this is going to be a hard one to let go of, and I prayed about it. Came to me was that this resentment was pretty handy. It was handy as an excuse that I tended to blame my father for a lot, maybe not even consciously, sometimes consciously, sometimes unconsciously, that like who I am, you know, that's because of my father, you know, or, you know, I'm this way because of my father. Well, I screwed that up. Well, if I didn't have a, you know, crappy father, And it became clear to me that this resentment was like an excuse, and that really made it difficult to let go of. You know, I really liked having that built-in crutch. Mm-hmm. So it did take a lot of prayer. I can't say that resentment went away, but I was able to get that relief, I'll say.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about some of the amends. You know, you had to start to make it, we'll say, 19, 20, 21. You know, mm-hmm. what were those like as that age versus perhaps amends that you had to make later as you got older in the program and maybe did a little deeper dive into your inventory?
Yeah, that was awkward. I did make some monetary amends to my brothers. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember, you know, giving money to my oldest brother, you know, to pay him back for what I'd stolen. And he was really uncomfortable taking the money. Mm-hmm. He was really uncomfortable talking about it, confessing up to the fact that I'd stolen money from him. Mm-hmm. And he was, you know, like I say, he was very gracious and, you know, still pretty young himself. Another amends that I made, I worked on a farm while I was, you know, in my active years. I was actually a riding stable and sort of was, in this work situation, sort of adopted by the old man, you know. So the guy that ran the farm, his father was, you know, his 80s. So I did a lot of work for him, you know, chopping wood, baling hay, whatever. And he passed away and I never showed. You know, they'd asked me to be a pallbearer and I never showed. So I called, made a phone call to the daughter, one of the daughters, to make an amends. And that was, like I said, really, really awkward.
Yeah. Right. I should have been there, right?
I should have been there. Yeah. So yeah, those are some of my first amends.
Okay. And so now let's take a little trip further down. So you're now in your 20s. I mean, did you start going to college and go to meetings, or what started happening in your 20s?
Yeah, my 20s. So yeah, I went to college. College was a great experience. It was a little bit nerve wracking. You know, so much drinking and partying going on. Yep. After college, I went to work. Like I said, at this point, my family had split up. My father was working overseas. At this point, I knew he'd gone to China, and I didn't know where he was. We had no contact. My brothers, I saw them minimally. My mother and I were, you know, still lived with my mother through college, and then mm-hmm. after college continued. At this point, she was starting to get bad health. You know, she started to get asthma mm-hmm. and, you know, allergies, and started to have, she had some falls and broke some bones. And so I stayed living with her. And of course, I don't know, it was just like sort of the last relative that I had. So, mm-hmm. you know, it worked for both of us, for me to continue to live at home. I started working, and really, even though I'd gone through the steps, I really just plunged myself into work. So really all of my energies, all of my creativity, you know, it was almost an obsession. You know, work was an easy place to hide out, you know. Okay. So really, that was my 20s. It's funny you say perhaps in your 20s. I talked to my current sponsor about that. And, you know, we both laughed. You know, he had a period of time in his life where we joke about it. We call it the self-imposed coma. Uh-huh. Or the self-induced coma. So it was, you know, throughout the 90s, my 20s, I just plunged into work. Really didn't have any personal relationships. I had, outside of the people that I, you know, casually knew at meetings and, you know, going to coffee and everything, and my sponsor, outside of that, I really didn't have any friends. It was really just work. So there's actually not a whole lot to tell, you know, from my 20s.
Well, and do you think there's any connection for you why you maybe kept people at arm's length and did stay, you know, detached from folks? Have you thought about what was going on there?
Yeah, I don't know if this would be a sort of a program approved point of view or a sort of a step based point of view, but I don't know. I think I'd really just. My disease, you know, I'd had such a harsh experience, you know, such a harsh beating at the hands of my disease. Family life was so crappy. I really just, you know, I think I was just really just shy of personal relationships. Mm-hmm. You know, I just, you know, shy isn't the right word.
Cautious.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know that I have any other sort of insight other than that. I once heard an alcoholic, actually I used to hear it a lot at meetings, is that show an alcoholic a rut and they'll furnish it and move in. That fit my case. You know, I think life was less challenging. Life was, you know, easier to deal with, you know, mm-hmm. if I just kept to my rut, you know, my rut was work. I guess that's probably the best I could say.
Yeah. I one of the favorite expressions I learned, early on is, yeah, someone said, you know, I'm tri addicted. Basically, if I tried it, I like it. I'm going to keep doing it. You know, it's like, you know, get to this workplace. I like it. I'm going to keep doing it, you know, and just lose yourself in something, because the reality of, again, looking at, you know, for me to look at the man in the mirror and say, there's some things that need to be changed. You know what? I'll just go back to work and ignore it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, really the turning point for me, if I could just talk about this for a minute,
please,
you know, I got the opportunity to, so it's, here I was still living in Syracuse. You know, I worked for a major retailer whose corporate offices were in New York City. So I got the opportunity to take, you know, working on my career furiously, I got the opportunity to take a position in the corporate office. So I'm not exactly sure if I was, but I told my mother, I won't take this position unless you come down there with me. Hmm. So I'm not entirely sure if I was trying to be helpful and I need to take care of my, you know, aging sick mother, or if I was just taking a hostage, I need to take someone with me, probably a little bit of both.
Sure.
So we came down here, my mother's health, you know, now it's, yeah, now I'm in my 30s. I was here for, I don't know, I guess like a decade. And then her health really, you know, she, actually before I get there. So once we got down here, you know, I had to establish myself in meetings down here. I had to, you know, get to know people, get a home group. You know, my mother, she did the same thing. My mother was still going to meetings. But at this point I was starting to feel trapped. You know, here I was taking on my career had advanced. I'm in the city. There's all sorts of opportunities, you know, social, just to have fun. And I think we were both of us sort of trapped in this relationship, sort of, you know, heavily leaning on each other.
Right.
So whereas in the beginning, you know, when the family first fractured and blew apart, and I think we really sort of clung to each other, and it was sort of a relief to have someone that you could depend on. At this point, I think we were really just sort of stuck with each other, and both stuck. And I'll just speak for myself. I know I certainly was. And I started to go to Al-Anon.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, this was, you know, I have to, just to give a quick plug for Al-Anon. You know, really, this is a way for me to work. It's the same 12 steps, almost word for word. They're identical.
Yeah.
And so really, this was a chance for me to, for me, this is an opportunity for me to apply the 12 steps to all of my personal relationships, not just my drinking. You know, mm-hmm. that's really for me what this amounted to. I got a sponsor. Who I still talk to, you know, almost every other day. And so this really, I started to become unfrozen, you know, and I started to you know, things started to shake up a little bit. At this point, this is when my mother was diagnosed with cancer, as it turns out. So here I was in Al-Anon. I was starting to, I was deeply dissatisfied with my life, really just sort of chomping at the bit. I wanted to experience more of life. I was still just working and taking care of things around the house and not doing much outside of going to meetings.
How old? You're about 40 or
40.
40.
Yeah.
Okay. So you got 24 years now, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Some things just aren't getting better.
And some things just aren't getting better. That's exactly right.
So your mom gets diagnosed. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So she was my mother. She got a call from her doctor after a routine visit, and they said, we saw something in your blood work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she intuitively knew something was up, you know, just the nature of the phone call. And I went with her, and, you know, they let her know that she's got lung cancer. And as it turns out, it was aggressive lung cancer. She passed away 4 months later. Mm-hmm. And so a few things happened with that diagnosis. First of all, we were both stunned, first of all, and we went to the hospital cafeteria and had like almost a wordless, cup of coffee and something to eat. Went home and I went to a meeting that night and I brought it up. I was scared. Like I said before, I was a beam me up Scotty kind of drinker. Mm-hmm. I didn't like to deal with reality. And this is about as real as it gets when, your beloved mother is diagnosed with cancer. And I thought, A, how am I going to stay sober? That wasn't a fear for me in the past, in the past 20 something years of sobriety, I wasn't afraid of picking up a drink. Now I was, I didn't crave a drink, but I was rattled to my core and I thought, how am I going to stay sober through this? And then number two, what's next? Am I going to lose my mother?
Right.
And, so I mentioned those two things in a meeting, and it actually, that for whatever reason, that was a meeting I'd never been to before. I mentioned it at my home group. The next 4 months, the cancer advanced rapidly. I became my mother's primary caregiver. Mm-hmm. I was going to work and then taking the train home. And, then I would put on my, start my second full-time job, which is, caring for my mom, right. My mother. I called my, I just knew what I had been doing in my program. So going to meetings, occasional phone calls, talking to my sponsor, talking to newcomers, starting my day with morning prayers. That wasn't enough. I just knew that wasn't going to cut it here. Mm. I don't know if it was a conscious decision, but it just sort of just happened. I just started to call my sponsor more than once a day. That I had a 7-minute walk home from the train and I called him and I would just blurt out everything that was going on. My 11th step, my meditation really ramped up. I can't be on the phone with my sponsor 24/7.
Right.
But I certainly have a lot of things that I need to deal with, 24/7, caring for my mother, dealing with my job, potentially, am I going to lose my mother? And then all of the things that made up care for my mother, doctor's appointments and visits and what's next for treatment, all of that stuff still needed to be dealt with and was swirling around my head on a moment by moment basis. So I prayed my relationship with God, got very close.
Yeah.
Some of the most powerful meditations I had were on the train on the way into work, like I said, the cancer advanced rapidly. I do want to say, something happened here. As it talks about in the literature, we don't pray for ourselves. It's suggested that we don't pray for ourselves. We can pray for other people, but, pray for other people. It's whatever we pray for, it should be of use to others. Mm-hmm. And there was one day where it was close to the end. It was the last few weeks of my mother's life. And she was on, heavy medication. I think it was morphine. And we'd gotten home and she'd just gotten her first prescription and she was in agony and she took the medication and, she's just in agony. And I just prayed and I said, God, grant me your wisdom, your love and your light. Boom, immediately it occurred to me. I remembered at some point in time, my mother told me that when the pain starts, when she lays down, she gets comfortable. So I suggested that she did. I'm like, oh, Mom, why don't you lay down? Mm-hmm. And she got peaceful. The pain started to ease up. The medications kicked in. So she was peaceful within a few minutes. I went to the mailbox. We'd just gotten home from, around the doctor's visits and getting the medication. So I went out to the porch to get the mail. And one of my coworkers who knew what was going on had sent me cookies. And it was really... just cookies. But at that moment, it was everything to me. It was, just someone else out there cares. I felt like my, I prayed and God answered my prayers immediately. I have no doubt in my mind that my prayers were answered. So unfortunately, it was a few weeks later, my mother passed away. Mm-hmm. And, I was just, my life was just upended. I felt like the rug had been pulled out from under me. I was grieving badly, grieving badly. And now all of a sudden, here's the one relationship I do have, as I mentioned, I just work and go to meetings.
Yep. You guys are very connected and dependent on each other. And now she's gone.
Yep. And now my best friend, my mother has now just died. And I'm thinking, what's my life going to be like? And, she died, in January. And, I remember, going for a walk just before she passed, thinking, wow, am I going to be alone? And that feeling really kicked in, and those thoughts overwhelmed me, right after she passed away. Over the years, sponsors and old timers had drilled into me, always say yes to the program. You mm-hmm. never say no to AA, always say yes to AA. And that really just, I think, saved my bacon. So I belong to a big home group in Westchester County in Mamaroneck, the Harbor Island group. And they have met, I think, 5 nights a week. And so I was going out so there's ample opportunity to go to the diner after the meeting. So mm-hmm. I was doing that all the time. So I wasn't going home to an empty apartment. I took on more service work. So I always had a service position within the group, whether it was chairing meetings or a speaker selection committee or, what have you. I started to sponsor more guys and take them through the steps. And so all of a sudden my life started to fill up, and I started to sort of navigate, the bare beginnings of human relationships, mm-hmm. Right. Sort of a crash course. So it was really, I really feel like it was some miracles. I went from feeling devastated and alone, and now my life was full, with AA. And then I started to now I still have lots of free time. And I remember, I didn't do things. I didn't go to concerts. I didn't have hobbies. I didn't go on dates. So I remember one Saturday morning, I had some free time, got a bagel and a coffee, went to a park. And, my sponsor often talked about taking baby steps. Mm-hmm. And I thought, this is clearly a place where I'm gonna have to take baby steps with, living life, learning how to live life. And I felt silly, because my big play for the weekend was walking to the park. I really felt conspicuous and stupid. And my sponsor really helpfully reminded me, that like, no, you're not gonna, your life was, you're not gonna go from 0 to 60 overnight. Mm-hmm. You have, these are necessary steps, going out to coffee, walking to the park, starting to do things. And that really started to speed up exponentially. My parents were immigrants. So when I notified my mother's side of the family, one of my cousins reached out to me. And so she came on a holiday to New York. My mother was British. She came on holiday to New York. And so I connected with that cousin, and I really started to connect with my overseas relatives. Really things started to happen. I started to travel a little bit. I started to date. And I'm missing something here, Howard. I wanted to just say, while I was caring for my mother, one of the things that happened, which was really for me, just an incredible experience, is that while she was sick and I was taking care of her, I was able to truly be there for another human being. Mm-hmm. In my past, my drinking life, it was really just self-centered. It was really just all about, me. Now I was facing up to reality. I had the courage to actually stay and be there and be present, and not only just be present, but to be her primary caregiver. And so that experience of actually being able to give back, mm-hmm. to my mother, to give something of myself to another human being without expecting anything in return. That was a first for me, and I'm grateful for that. And I know that it was, clear for me. Clearly, I wouldn't have been able to do that without my sponsor, meetings, my higher power. So for me, that being able to be present and give back, that in itself was a gift.
Mm. That's a incredible story of dedication and fellowship. And when you said the cookies, it's just cookies that they sent, but it was like the best cookies you could have gotten that day, because you could have went and bought cookies, but getting it from somebody saying, what, so you're thinking of me during this time? Because all I can think about is what's going on, and like, oh, so other people are thinking about me. Wow. You even said, tapping the resources of the program, not realizing how much fellowship there really is and how much you can get involved when you need to. And I'll just recall a time, I think I was, 12 years sober, and I just moved to New Jersey, and I was not dealing well with the change from North Carolina to New Jersey. The culture is a little different, as you might imagine. And I was just, and this woman who I went on, I happened to go on a date with her from one of these services. It was a computer matching thing. But when we met, found out we were both in the program. She had 1 or 2 years, and here I have, 12, and I'm sitting in her car, and I figured it out because she had the Serenity Prayer on the dashboard or something. And we both said, oh yeah, I figured you were in the program. And so we didn't get romantically involved, but we became friends in general. So we, travel to meetings, we go to other events together, and I wasn't getting better, really. I was still just this miserable guy. And she says to me this in the sweetest voice, she says, sounds like someone needs a coffee commitment. And yeah, you're laughing, right? And I'm like, do you know who I am? I have 12 years. We don't do coffee commitments at 12 years anymore. That's for new people. In my mind, I swear that's, this arrogance in my mind. So that probably was on a Friday or Saturday night she said that. So the next Saturday, I was the coffee guy at the meeting I normally go to. And you know what? It was the best. I had the best time making coffee, and being more involved, and because that's really what happened. It wasn't that I was unhappy in New Jersey. It's just I hadn't fully moved yet, and I hadn't embraced that I was here. And so once I took the commitment, and people saw me every week and connected and talked to me, and we got involved in each other's lives. Oh well, now I finally moved to New Jersey. It only took me 2 years and 1 weekend, to move to New Jersey. My mind just didn't follow. So, I'm so grateful to the program. Giving those resources. Go ahead.
Okay. For me, it was a 20-year period where I didn't fully tap into the program. Of course, I tapped into the program and I stayed sober. I guess, as you said earlier, what you put into the program, you get back exponentially. That's been my experience. And not only does the program just works, it doesn't just help you stay sober. It works in every aspect of your life. And I just from this experience learned that the more of myself and my life I trust to the program, the better my life is.
Mm-hmm. The program, I think it works when you want it to, but it works way more than when you don't want it to. It is going and going and just like, oh, my disease is doing pushups. Well, you know what? The program's doing, working you a little bit too. You don't really realize it.
Yeah.
So in some of the preparation, I asked, what are some areas where you kind of had to lay aside prejudice, where you kind of thought, this is the way things are and this is the way they're going to be. And then things change. I like to say in How It Works is that, we had to let go of our old ideas. Well, some of those old ideas are after 20 years of sobriety, you believe one thing and you realize. So can you share some of the things you share with me?
Yeah, absolutely. As I mentioned, I had this resentment against my father that I really sort of talked about with my sponsor during my fifth step. My father was, I had no idea where he was. He was out of my life, and I was out of his life for about 20 years. I had no idea on the globe where he was. He was gone to work in China. I'd heard that he'd come back to the States. And for me, that was I was completely happy with that distance. You know, we'd had such a bad relationship that, I thought, this works for me. And if we never see each other again, that's going to be great, because I don't have to face this relationship. I don't have to face him. And so the prejudice that I had to lay aside was just this resentment. My oldest brother, he had gotten married, and come to find out, he had, so none of us knew where my father was. My mm-hmm. oldest brother, after he got married and had a daughter, he realized, I don't want my daughter not to have a grandfather. I don't want her not to know, her only relative in the U.S. So he found my father and, had gotten in touch with him, and, didn't say anything about it. And then a year or two later, had let me know about it. And then now, my comfortable position of not having to deal with this relationship with my father, now that comfortable idea had been smashed, yeah. Now I know where my dad is. My brother has a relationship with him. And all of a sudden it started to become uncomfortable to not do something about that. And many conversations with my sponsor. I got my father's contact information. He was now remarried, living in Arizona in Phoenix. Reached out to my father, and
I just want to interrupt. And at this point, were you still blaming him for the way you were, or had you let go of that?
I want to say yes, but that's not true. There's still a part of me that was blaming him. Absolutely, 100%, 100%. That resentment wasn't gnawing at me on a daily basis anymore, but it was still,
it was in the back pocket, right?
Still in the back pocket, absolutely. Yeah. That I could take out when needed.
Yep.
So I reached out to my father, and come to find out, he now had Parkinson's, and before I talk about that, I just want to say my takeaway from me thinking about this on my own without talking to my father, my takeaway was that my father didn't like me or my brothers, and I felt like when I was growing up, my brothers got more attention than I did. I really felt like I just wasn't even on his radar. So my takeaway was that he didn't like me, that I just wasn't enough, for him to even care about. And I could back that up with, look at this. He's been gone for 20 years and I haven't seen hide nor hair of him. So, it just backed up my assumptions, my prejudice. When I made that first phone call to my father, and I knew he had Parkinson's and he was living in an assisted living facility, and his wife answered the phone and said, my father's name was Rolf. Rolf, it's Marcus. And he was in a wheelchair, but from the sounds of it, I think he must have, run over a couple of orderlies on the way, and dove for the phone and crashing, and he was breathless, and I could hear tears in his voice, and he was so happy to get the call from me. And so right there was the first chip in my, and my comfortable assumptions, that I've got this, crappy father who doesn't care and my life sucks because of him. And so we spoke for quite some time and really just caught up a little bit, and he invited me to come out. And so I made arrangements, and one of my brothers came with me, not the brother that had already seen him, but the middle brother. When I told him I was going, he said, "Can I come with you? I don't think this is the kind of trip I could do alone." So we went together and spent a week in Arizona with my father and his wife. And a lot of the conversation, we didn't have a ton of deep, in-depth conversations. We did have a few. So I did hear, when he talked about, it was actually his wife that prompted him to talk. My father wasn't a big talker. And he wasn't blaming, but he was just talking about his relationship with my mother. And I really started to understand a different side of the story.
Okay.
So over the years, I just heard my mother's take on the relationship and entered his side. And then I guess sort of the big thing that happened was, as we were getting ready to say goodbye, you know, we're sitting in my father's room in this, you know, in this home for the elderly, and we're saying goodbye, and he says goodbye to my brother first, my brother Nick. And he's saying, you know, he made such a big deal out of it. You know, he's like, Nick, you know, over the years, I've just been so worried about you. I was just afraid we were going to lose you. I'm so glad to see that you're doing okay. And I'm off to the side just burning, you know, that resentment. It's not in my back pocket anymore.
Oh,
you know,
here it
I'm
is.
Like, yeah, yeah, it's out. And I'm just thinking, what the hell? You know, it's me that came out. He just tagged along, you know, and here we are again. I feel like I'm 8 years old, you know, my brother's getting the attention and, you know, I feel left out. And then after he's, you know, this long, you know, conversation with my brother, he turned to me and he said, you're always okay. And just that phrase said a lot to me. I didn't get it all right away. We said our goodbyes and I started to think, you know, that we're on the long flight home, that, you know, my brothers, they were such wild men, like I talked about, that he was terrified. And so he was so full of concern for them and chasing them around, you know, and I was always the good kid and did sort of my drinking behind the scenes, you know, that,
Under the radar, you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I really just understood. I got the gift of understanding, you know, is the way I like to think about it. You know, the prayer of St. Francis, you know, understand rather than be understood. And it's not that he didn't love me. It's just that he was, you know, consumed with fear about my two older brothers. They kind of got all the attention. So of course that didn't erase, you know, erase the relationship that we had, the fact that we didn't have a good relationship and the fact that I did have those feelings, but that resentment at that point was gone. Now the resentment is just gone. Yeah. And so we did, thankfully we did get a chance to see each other a few more times, and he unfortunately passed away from Parkinson's, but I was able to have a wonderful few visits with him. It meant the world to be able to, even though we didn't have any big conversations after that, but just to be able to just tool around Phoenix, see the sights, and just talk about things. For me not to be consumed by that resentment, you know, it just felt like that relationship had a fresh start. So to be able to have, it was a blessing. And again, that's, for me, that's a gift of the program to be able to have that.
Yeah. When you mentioned the, kind of him, you know, rolling over orderlies to get to talk to you, that sensation of he probably wanted to talk to you even more than you wanted, you know, to rekindle something with him, because, you know, and it almost says that, yeah, he didn't feel good about what had happened over the years, just didn't have the tools to say, to reach across and say, I need to talk to you about how lousy I feel about being a dad, you know. And
100%.
Yeah, I think your dad, my dad, were a similar generation. I remember years ago having a huge knockdown drag out with my father, and there were, you know, nothing physical, but a lot of yelling going back and forth, and it was all over like some insult about my weight during a meal or something. And I just clocked him with it. I said, how could you talk to me that way? How could you? And he said, well, that's how I grew up. That's how, you know, my dad helped me. And that's, you know, and he really thought he was helping, you know, and we kind of went to our corners, and he kind of came back in the room where I was, and cause I was staying with him. This is in the Chicago area and I didn't live there, but I was staying with him. So I was like trapped, like there's nowhere to go. And he comes into the bedroom where I was, and he says, "Listen, I'm sorry. I don't know how to do this, and I hope you know that I hugged my dad 3 times in my whole life, you know." And he starts to describe what his childhood was like, and really how void it was of attention and love, and that was normal to him, and so the relationship we had was a lot of hugs, a lot of connection, a lot of, you know, but sometimes he reverted to this path of where he came from. And when he just realized that that was not what he wanted, you know, what he had, you know, cause he realized this connection was starting to get fractured, and it could stay that way, you know, and we came back together on that. And just like you, I had an understanding of like, wow, I thought I had, you know, he neglected me here and there. It's like, oh, I wasn't neglected at all compared to what he had, you know? So, and you never know, right. Like we don't, you know, our parents don't like wear little name tags that say, oh, by the way, I was hit every day as a kid, every time I came home from school. You know, they're just not going to do that. They're going to try to hide all the hurt from us. They don't really want to pass that on to us in many cases, but now I'm a parent. You're a parent. And it's like, oh, okay. I did not understand hardly anything that was going on from that side of the, you know, the equation. So,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I have, it's funny as you're saying that, I've just been something that has occurred to me over and over again. I have a 2.5-year-old and a newborn son. My wife and I have been married for 4 years now, and it's wonderful to, you know, have a family, and I'm just so grateful. So I feel like Leo, the late bloomer here.
Yeah. Well, you had them at, you're the youngest at 46 or no, 48.
Yeah. 48.
Okay.
48.
How old's your wife?
She is 10 years younger than me.
Okay. Okay. And so you're 50 having a couple of newborns, right?
Yes.
Two diapers, absolutely. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. That. Yeah,
and which I'll just say for the audience, because I'm like on a little video recording session here with Marcus, and it's like he looks fantastic right now. It's 9:30 at night, and he looks great for a guy who has to deal with this. So go ahead.
Sorry. Well, thank you. Yeah. It certainly doesn't feel that way. Yeah, I do. It's yes. Yeah, the mornings or in the middle of the night, at times when one of them wakes up, I feel like I'm, you know, being resurrected from the dead to deal with it. But I'm so happy, I'm, you know, just before you and I started this interview, I said goodnight to my two sons. It's kind of a ritual. My wife and I sit down and read a story to my oldest son, and you know, I have the youngest, the newborn, in my arms, and you know, so we read a couple of storybooks and we talk about the day and. You know, and play some games. I talk in a silly pirate voice. This is my favorite time of day, bar none. My favorite time of day. One of the things that I've been thinking about a lot in this past 2 years, now that I've become a parent, is, you know, every once in a while at a meeting, you'll hear people say, you know, I was raised by wolves. You know, and I always got a chuckle out of that. And that's so great. That's so true. And over the past 2 years, you know, I think, you know, like I said, my parents were immigrants. So when they came here, they didn't have a support system, you know,
right.
There really weren't the resources back then, you know, in the late 60s when they got here. So my mother, my two brothers were, you know, they're a couple years older than me. I was born soon after they hit American soil. So there was my mother with three sons. And you know, over the years, you know, they really, you know, as I found out, like, you know, really took a lot to make ends meet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my mother was, you know, stretching the last can of tuna fish, you know, over a couple of meals. And but, you know, I just think about it, like, you know, I never felt like we were poor, you know?
Right.
And you know, I think about all the good that my parents did. Now I see that what a difficult job this parenting thing is. And how scary it is. Mm-hmm. And you know, just with one, I was just like, why are we having two? And we have two. And I'm like, and I think she had three, you know, and she really didn't have any help. And I just think lately my thoughts about what a fantastic job, you know, my parents did, or at least what a great job they did with the tools they had, you know. And I think of you know, the gifts that we received, you know, from my parents, you know, you know, so I've been thinking about that lately more than I've been thinking about, you know, their defects, you know.
Sure.
And, you know, and I just think, so I think that's one thing that having kids and being sober has taught me is ease up on the judgment a little bit, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and look,
I hope no one, you know, I hope no one sees me in my worst moments, you know, now, you know what I mean? And there are plenty of bad moments as a parent, you know, I think my intentions are only the best for my kids and for my wife. And I know that inevitably I'm going to come up short, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And look, this is not to say there are some unforgivable things that happen between parents and children. And I'm not saying that, but I'm saying, you know, I'm thinking when you were describing, you know, your dad, the, you know, end of life, and your mom and her end of life, and, you know, and they, you know, he split a while back, and, you know, my folks were married for 26 years before they split up. And now that I got to know them, you know, as an adult, because I was 19, so I knew them more as an adult, and I was sober, you know, for most of the relationship as an adult and everything. And I got to know them and say, wow, you know, these guys probably should have married each other. They were not a great match, you know, but they did, and they made the best they could for me and my brother, and it was pretty good. And even after they split up, they did, you know, they made it pretty good. And, you know, knowing, and I was married once before, and it wasn't a great match. I was not mature enough to be a husband. And now, I met my wife, you know, 13 years ago. We've been married 10 years, and, you know, I'm a much better match now, you know, thank you. And again, you know, I even have a little joke. You know, I celebrated, you know, 31 years. I met her when I had 20 years, you know, so, she's not exactly impressed that I'm sober so much as that I'm growing as a man and as a husband and a father. You know, it's like, oh, that's nice, but when I met you were sober, so
that's right.
Well, what else you got, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, right. It's more of a little, you know, we have a good sense of humor about that stuff, but because there's been time, you know, something as simple as, you know, putting together furniture, you know, we did that the other day, and we said, okay, let's hug in the beginning and let's hug in the middle and let's hug at the end, you know, because it's an IKEA, you know, dresser that's going to split up this relationship, you know? It's just that, you know, sometimes that making that choice to, again, be loving instead of unkind. And you know, with your kids, like you're making every decision you can to do the loving right thing, and then you know what? It's gonna lapse. One day you're gonna make a bad decision, and they're gonna remind you of it. I mean, my son reminds me a couple of things that I came a little unglued on, and one of them was I like telling the story. It was in the morning. I always asked him, "Hey, could you wipe off the sink in the bathroom?" You know, just leave spots, and it was just me and him in that bathroom. My wife had the master, you know. And so one morning, before I went to a meeting, there's spots, so I took toothpaste and I drew circles around the spots, okay, to indicate that they were there. And this is, I'll say, 26 years of sobriety on my way to a meeting. Here I am at 6 a.m. drawing toothpaste circles, okay? Yeah. So it's funny now, but, and I got home later after the meeting, and I apologize for being way out of line on that and everything. So now, so, you know, years later, something happens, and let's say he accidentally drops the ice tray or something in the kitchen, and I'll be like, before I say anything, he's like, "All right, should I go get the toothpaste so you can draw a circle around it?" Yeah. So, you know, sometimes some of these mistakes become happy reminders of that. All right, so I don't draw toothpaste around his mistakes anymore, but
yeah,
but that's, you know,
we had a, yeah, my laughter is somewhat uncomfortable and nervous because sure. I had a similar experience with my wife. We were, I've sort of taken over cleaning the bathroom. You know, I like the way I clean the bathroom.
Of course.
You know, and you know, it's done to my satisfaction when I do it. And, you know, when I go to put some dishes in the dishwasher, you know, I'm like, oh my gosh, what's going on in here? And I, you know, sort of straighten everything out and get a lot more in there. And we were visiting my brother and sister-in-law. My wife and my sister-in-law were talking, and somehow they started talking about the dishwasher. And my sister-in-law started saying how my brother will go in and start, you know, correcting, you know, all of the dishes that were, you know, weren't put in the dishwasher correctly. Mm-hmm. And then she got fed up and she's like, "Why am I doing this? Why am I putting dishes in the dishwasher if you're just going to do it?" And, you know, she's a social worker. So she's, you know, a tough, smart cookie. She's not having it. So she's like, "You know what? That job's yours now. You know,
congratulations.
You're just going to redo it. It's yours now." And then my wife, I could see her. She said, "Marcus does the same thing. And he does it with the bathroom too." And she said, "You know, I'm 40 and I've been cleaning the bathroom for all of my adult life. I thought I knew how to clean the bathroom, but evidently I don't."
Yeah, apparently not.
So, Thankfully, it was kind of a really, it was a lot of laughter in that conversation. But I could see that my wife, that's something that you know, really bothered and burned her. After a couple of days, I had to make an amends. You know, I just said, you know, thankfully this is an easy situation, a lighter one. You know what? You know, I'm sorry. I would love help doing the dishes. So yes. I'll never criticize, you know, your bathroom cleaning skills again.
Yeah, because I had a joke years ago because I had a fight over a dishwasher. I've had actually both wives now, first one and this one. And I said, I think I'm just going to write a book, you know, how to load a dishwasher and 40 other ways to split up your marriage, you know, just because. And now our rule is that if I get it in the dishwasher, that's enough. She will rearrange. Could you just get it in and I'll do the rest. Yeah. So yeah. Division of labor. Right.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Obviously you started dating and got married because now you have kids and I want to know, because you said you were kind of void of hobbies. Are there any hobbies you picked up in sobriety that maybe some you didn't think you could do? And it's like, oh, I can do this. Is there anything like that?
Yeah, kayaking.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, my oldest brother, he, avid fisherman. He lives out on Long Island and, you know, got sea kayaks and, you know, just, you know, whatever. But he was getting rid of one of his kayaks and, I bought that from him and, I thought, wow, this is like a whole new world. You know, this is wonderful. This is a lot of fun. And as it turns out, when, I was dating my wife, we spent our first two summers at the shore. Mm-hmm. She and her friends, they rented a house on the shore the first summer that we were dating. And, one of the back bays, there was a little island, you know, I'll call it, it's like a little sandbar. Okay. And we all just had the idea of, let's get a flotilla together, you know? And so we loaded up kayaks and, paddle boards and went out to the island. And I remember being really conscious of, just how much fun that was. And actually another hobby, I started to run.
Okay.
When I was in high school, I was, my junior high and, you know, first couple of years of high school, I was drinking and drugging. You know, I didn't get involved in anything. And then, you know, second 2 years of high school and college, I was really just trying to figure myself out. I really just had this idea that some of these things were for other people, you know, sports, you know, joining band, all that stuff is for other people. It's for people who aren't alcoholics and drug addicts. It's for normal people.
Mm-hmm. Kind of energy?
Yeah. Right. Exactly. So after my mother passed away, I don't know what way I went for a run. I don't remember what prompted me to go for a run, but I did. And, the local high school, allowed the community to use the track. Mm. And so I really started to get into running. Really get into it. I enjoyed it. And I started to run on the track and, I've spoken to other runners who they like to, you know, cross country run. Mm. They find track running really boring. But for me, you know, this running on a track, you know, that this is a track that's designed, you know, for running. You know, I felt like I'm doing something that I'd always thought other people should do, you know? So for me, for every lap around that high school track, it was just sort of an F you to that diseased notion that this is something for other people, you know?
Nice. Very nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. I got into pottery and, I didn't think I was a very artistic person at all. And what it turned out is like, no, I'm not a painter, but I do like the wheel pottery. And when I did that, and it was out of a moment of darkness that I had to start doing that shortly after moving to New Jersey as well. And my teacher, who is a wonderful spiritual man, I was very scared. He said, "Why is that?" I said, "Well, I tried this when I was like 8 years old at the YMCA, and I was awful at it." He said, "Well, I think I know why." I said, "Why is that?" He says, "Because 8-year-olds can't really do pottery." the coordinate is like, yes. Oh, okay.
Right. He says, right. Bingo.
Right. As a 34 year old, you should be able to do it now. So let me show you how to do it. And I did very well. And so, yeah, it's again, surprise myself. surprised other people. And he, yeah, he loved watching me evolve in that childlike way. We've come to that part where I like to ask about a book or something, you know, outside of our AA literature that has you know, enhanced your journey or added value to what's going on in your life. And you did share something with me. Could you share that with the audience, please?
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, it was actually a sponsor that suggested this book to me. It's called Letters of the Scattered Brotherhood. And it's edited by Mary Strong. And it's a collection of open letters. And, you know, the idea was just to have, you know, people of faith. None of the people are identified. They're all anonymous. Mm-hmm. You know, just talk about the idea of developing a relationship with God, and the prayer life, and, you know, the inner life. For me, this book was a big help in a couple of ways. You know, one was just that, that I could think of my spiritual life as almost like a third entity, you know, mm-hmm. You know, that's something that my spiritual self that I could train and develop. You know, I could make decisions about what to do. I can go to meetings. I can talk to a sponsor, you know, and it really sort of helped me, you know, sort of think about that, you know, that I'm making decisions about, you know, my spiritual life and how I can develop it. You know, another thing that it really helped me with is just the idea that, you know, a lot of the benefit that I get is just from the action. It's just from the intent of actually doing it, you know, rather than, you know, doing things that are, you know, negative or, you know, injurious to myself. It's just the attempt at doing things, you know, starts to build on itself.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. And you did write in some of the pre-show prep about your kind of reworking steps 2 and 3 after a long yes. term. Can you go into that as maybe it connects with this book?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this is current. This is very current. You know, I just got to a point where I found myself just asking myself, you know, who or what exactly am I praying to? And does God really exist? Is there really a, you know, some sort of a being out there that I've got a personal relationship with? Mm-hmm. And I don't know where that came from. I've often thought about it. I don't know. I think there is a part of me that, you know, now that I've married and, you know, and then I got married and had 2 kids and, yeah, I think sort of a lot of the painful events of my early sobriety and middle sobriety and later sobriety, you know, the getting sober and, you know, the breakup of my family, the loss of my parents, you know, a lot of that, you know, what I'm going to call scary, bad stuff, it mm-hmm. seems to be over. And now I've, you know, got my own family and things are really good. There's a part of me that was like, you know what, if there is a God, you know, why don't you leave me alone now? Things are really good.
Yeah.
So I'm afraid if I keep this relationship up that you might give me some more of that other stuff. So just leave me alone for a while. I don't know if that's where it came from. But I for whatever reason, the idea just took hold, that is there really a God? And I'm not sure that there is one. And which was, of course, terrifying. You know, as I talked about earlier, you know, during the time when, you know, some of the times when my life was toughest, you know, it was God that really sustained me. It's my relationship mm-hmm. with God that sustained me. And now here I am, you know, and so the prospect of living life without a God, is terrifying. And so this really, I don't know, there are 3 people in the rooms that helped me. And one was just a random share that I heard at a meeting. And the topic happened to be about, you know, prayer and meditation and this, or about God, you know, second step. And this guy said, you know, the only proof that I need about God is that since I've been praying, you know, my life has gotten better. You know, that's, mm-hmm. that's it. And that struck a chord with me. I'm like, you know, I've got 30 plus years of evidence that, you know, I've been praying, my life has gotten better. The second person to help me was a guy in my home group, Billy. And we were talking about it and he said, you know, Marcus, he was like, you know, sit down. He's like, let me just ask you. He said, you know, you've been receiving God's blessings for the past 30 years and now you're questioning him,
right.
You know? And the third person that helped me was, another guy with long-term sobriety, and you know, I tend to think of myself as overly analytical, and this guy is just the same. He's the same character as me, and we were talking after a meeting, and I opened up to him. He's got long-term sobriety. I opened up to him about it. And he said, yeah, Marcus, and you know, I was expecting him to be shocked, and he wasn't. And he said, you know, Marcus, I would just encourage you, try not to think about God as a construct, try not to define God and what his characteristics are, and you know, just essentially just do the action, you know, do the footwork. So those three things have helped me, and this is something that's just been unfolding over the past few months. Mm-hmm. And I guess hopefully what's happening is just that my relationship with my higher power is just developing, you know, and hopefully that's what this situation is, you know what I mean? Because I don't doubt that there's a higher power. I think that the higher power that I knew or understood, the higher power of my understanding of 5 years ago, is not the higher power of my understanding today.
Right.
But I certainly do have a higher power in my life.
Yeah. I was kind of making this connection when you talked about your father, and sometimes, you know, we say Heavenly Father, right? And how you thought your father was, you know, something that he turned out not to be, and he was much better than what you thought, or you had a better understanding after you knew him better. And perhaps the same kind of thing with your Heavenly Father is, all right, there are some things that I thought, and now I don't, and I have to reestablish that relationship a little bit, you know, and I've gone through something similar, and mine was more about like, I'm done. I don't want to have to go to meeting. You know, every time I move to a new city, I'm like, I don't want to do a new fellowship and a new meeting list and a new sponsor. I really was almost done. And I think at a certain point, many of the people I know do have this phase of almost giving up. They don't, but it's like, okay, so I'm not alone in that. And you're not alone in that. And to hear other people, like you said, came to you and said, nope, we'll get you through it. We'll get you through that. Also, just again, what a blessing.
Yeah, and it's so funny. That's true. Very similar experience. I lived in Westchester County when I met my wife. When we were dating, I moved to New Jersey, and so starting all over again. So as I mentioned, I was really tight in my group at Harbor Island, you know, and it was almost like, you know, the sober version of Cheers, you know, where you walk in, you know, Norm, you know, walk into the room, Marcus, you know, everybody knew me and what was going strange, you know, a new state, strange city, strange meetings. They do things differently here. So I wonder if that played a part as well. It was really difficult to get plugged back into a home group. And it took a lot of bouncing around for about a year before I found my current home group. And then it was even longer before I started to get to know the guys and, you know, started to get, you know, to the point where I started to have close relationships with some of them. And without a doubt, what you said, Howard, is very true. You know, it really was scared. Like, you know, I started to think, is this the end of my, you know, 'cause my meeting attendance was crappy. You know, I really just didn't have that deep phone list, and the phone calls I did make weren't really as deep, you know? So I did start to wonder, like, is this the end of my time in AA? And thankfully, no. Mm-hmm. And, it's the group that saved me. It's my higher power that saved me. It's, you know, some of the individual relationships I've had. It's not like I'm looking all on this and looking back on it in the distant past. This is something that's very much unfolding for me today. You know, it's very much a work in progress.
Yeah. Well, we're coming to the end here, and I like to give my guests a chance to talk about is something that we didn't cover that you wanted to, or just use the platform to you know, project something that you've learned over the years that you'd like the audience to know about, or if you don't, that's okay too.
Yeah, I just want to bring up again something I mentioned earlier, and that's just to say yes to the program. Mm. So, A, because I know it works, and B, to honor the, you know, succession of old timers and sponsors that continuously, you know, said that to me. I'll be the voice to say that to whoever's listening is say yes to the program. whatever it is, making coffee, you know, being the coffee maker, as your friend suggested you become, you know, getting a sponsor, or, you know, going on an outgoing, you know, to another meeting, anything, just say yes. And, you know, I promise that the benefits will come quick and fast and heavy.
Yeah. Me and my sponsor talk about this concept. We have become the they. Like when someone says, oh, they told me to do this, I'm the they now, because I'm the older guy saying, oh, you got to do this. Yeah. And we have now become they. And it's a little scary. Like, oh, gosh, I'm carrying the torch.
It is. My sponsor actually said that.
Yeah.
One of my sponsors actually said that. He was like, he made that point. It was during a meeting, and he was like, you know, he said, now it's up to you, you know, and he called a few of us out by name during the meeting. Mm-hmm. And it hit me like, you know, you want me to take this on? Are you kidding me? You know, it's a little scary. But we do all do this together.
Yes.
So whether it's talking to a newcomer or talking to my sponsor or talking to a friend, you know, it's a mutual thing, you know. You know, I certainly get a lot out of every conversation, and I hope some, you know, the other person in the conversation gets something out of it too. But that's just the way, that's one of the miracles of AA. A second thing I just want to say about the program, and something I would want to pass on to maybe anybody who's listening that's curious about the program or hasn't quite committed. One of the things that I found is someone who is really stubborn and really skeptical of the program, and, you know, I almost wish that it didn't work in the beginning, is I have found no reason not to come. And the longer I've spent in the meetings, the more meetings I've gone to, particularly the more tradition meetings I've gone to, and I guess this is sort of a plug for the traditions as well. When you read the traditions, everything is there out on paper, you know, their first decades of experience, you know, it's all on paper. Here's what we did. Here's the harebrained things that we tried that didn't work. You know, we made lots of rules that didn't work. You know, we tried this, that didn't work. So there's, you know, AA, you know, it's like the only organization I know of that they're not hiding anything, you know, and everything is out on the table.
Yeah.
You know, so there's no hidden doors, no hidden secrets, no one behind the scenes pulling the strings. It's just a bunch of alcoholics getting together, just as the preamble says, you know, helping each other. And, you know, the more I've delved into the program, the more experience I've had with it, you know, the more I find that to be exactly the case. So for anybody who's listening who maybe is doubtful of the program, believe me, you know, I've checked it out. It's cool. It's okay. It's safe. Jump in.
Come on in. Water's fine. So.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, thank you. This has been an incredible journey through your story and sharing it with you and sharing some of the things that, you know, are tough to get out there. So thanks again for joining the podcast today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity. I was excited, you know, to have this opportunity. So I really enjoyed it. This was a fun conversation.
We have come to the end of this episode of the Seasons of Sobriety podcast. I trust that you were able to identify with the personal story of our guest and perhaps apply some of their experience to give you the hope needed to persevere through your own journey. If you'd like to contact the show, please send an email to podcast@seasonsofsobriety.com. The email address can be found in the show notes. This podcast has been completely self-funded. If you believe today's episode has been beneficial, I ask that you either contribute a little extra this week to your home group or another organization close to your heart. Until next time, remember, if you have trouble practicing the principles of the steps in all your affairs, you may have too many affairs.